All right, it occurred to me that you might have a problem sorting out who's who in this novel. It gets a little confusing. Part one is really a kind of introduction to the major players and what's going on. So I thought I'd begin by just going over some of these characters with you and their relationships. However, I have to point out that your translation, which I believe is the Magashak, right? Or do I have the same translation as you do? This one?
Yes.
Something like that. Magashak tends to anglicize, or gallicize in some cases, the first names of a number of these characters. So, for example, Mavriki is Maurice, and let's see who else. Stepan is Stephen, I believe, and there are a few other similar. Let's see. Anybody else need one of these? So, these are the Russian names transliterated into Roman equivalents, of course, Roman alphabet equivalents. All right, so we don't know the familia, the family name of the narrator of the story, but we know his first name is patronymic. Well, we know the first and last letters of his family name. G and V. By the way, just for the fun of it, I went online and looked at some of the plot summaries and character lists and descriptions on the internet. Don't do it. Boy, are they off sometimes. I mean, it's a mixture of, yes, this is an adequate description of what's going on in the novel, and what? Where did they get that? So. Anton, by the way, I put all the accents in here. Anton Lavrentyevich, something. It could be anything. It could be Godorov. It could be, who knows, Gavrilov. There's Varvara, and you know, of course, that Varvara is the Russian equivalent of Barbara. Varvara Petrovna Stavrogina. The A is the feminine of Stavrogin, the family name. And therefore her son, down the middle of the page, Nikolai, which I think is Nicholas in your translation, Nikolai Vyacheslavovich Stavrogin. Vyacheslav is his father, so he's Vyacheslavovich. These things are usually sort of compressed when they're spoken. There is, of course, Stepan Trofimovich Verkhovensky. There is his son, Piotr. Peter, which I think is what Magashak gives, Pyotr Stepanovich, or Petrusha, or Pierre, when his father is speaking French, Verkhovensky, a man whom we know only by his family name, Shigalyov. And what we have listed here is not everybody, but some of the principal figures in the circle, under the direction, or at least presided over by their elder statesman, their eminence grise, you might say, Stepan Trofimovich Verkhovensky. Among them is Sergei Yegorovich Liputin, Alexei Nilyich Kirillov, and Ivan Pavlovich Shatov, and sometimes called Shatushka. All right, so their relationships here are indicated somewhat. Ignat Yebadkin, Yebyadkin is not a member of the circle. He comes in subsequently, and his sister Maria Ignatyevna Lebyadkin is half sane, lame sister, then, who is secretly married to Nikolai. And we find this, or we surmise this much, if we are attentive to details, by the end of part one. There's something strange going on, and we don't understand why Shatov slaps with his fist, slaps Stavrogin at the end of that, unless we understand what's going on. So there's been an insult of sorts delivered, and we are not quite clear about what's happening. Now let's back up a little bit. In Varvara Petrovna's circle, or at least those people that we see who are directly associated with her, as opposed to her friend, Stepan Trofimovich, who is, we'll get to him in a minute. There is also the new provincial governor. This is the third of provincial governors that they've had. And since Varvara Petrovna is a prominent person in town, she's known all of them. His wife, Yulia Mikhailovna von Lembeke, or Lemke, his wife, and there is a curious relationship here. Tushin, the first husband of Praskovya Ivanovna Drozdov, was related to the governor's wife. So there are all kinds of family connections and, in some cases, sub rosa connections among these characters. But for our purposes right now, all you need to know is who these people are and why they're where they are. All right, so Praskovya Drozdov is an old friend of Varvara Petrovna. Lizaveta Nikolaevna Tushin is the daughter of Praskovya Ivanovna by her first husband, Tushin. Her second husband, who's also deceased, Drozdov, then gives her, is somehow distantly related to Mavriki Nikolaevich Drozdov, and he in turn is engaged to Lizaveta Nikolaevna Tushin, the daughter of Praskovya Ivanovna. Okay, got all of that? Well, that's why I did this little list for you. This way you can at least refer to it and keep track of it. And by the way, I have put it on Blackboard if you lose it, or if you don't happen to have it with you and you're near a computer. Okay, so there they are. Now, there are two things I want to talk about today by way of introduction to the novel. One is a continuation of the apocalypse theme, but that also in conjunction with the notion of the demonic, because this title, and by the way, there are at least three different titles that translate the beshi, that is, demons or devils, it's the plural in Russian. And there are no definite and indefinite articles in Russian, so it could be the devils or just devils, or in a more recent translation, demons. However, the Constance Garnett translation rendered it as the possessed, And some critics have objected to that translation, although in some ways it seems quite apt, as we'll see later on, that the novel is not about the persons who have had the demons enter into them, but is about the demons themselves. In any case, in some sense or another, it is true that a large number of the characters in this novel are indeed demonically possessed, but it's not about their possession. It is about some force that drives them, that's beyond them. Because Dostoevsky really doesn't demonize them exactly, the characters in this novel. He presents them really in an odd way, somewhat from the inside, even though, because of the narrator, he has to present them utterly from the outside. Now, the narrator is a close friend, even a sort of confidant, he's called once or twice in the novel, of Stepan Trofimovich. And he is our source for everything in the novel. Now, here Dostoevsky takes a turn in narrative device that he will use again in The Karamazov Brothers, and that is to have a person who is an eyewitness of the action of the novel tell the story. But it also does something else, because in this particular novel, Dostoevsky uses this Anton Lavrentyevich to a definite advantage. That is, his narrator is almost, though not quite, like the central intelligence in a Henry James novel. In other words, he doesn't know everything. He's not an omniscient narrator. Now, we do wonder how he knows certain things later on in the book. Presumably, he's been told them by somebody else. So he's our authority for everything in the novel. And quite often, we discover that he has been told something, because he is not simply Stepan Trofimovich's confidant. He seems to be a confidant, or at least, if you will, a person to whom things are told throughout the novel. On the other hand, he is as much in the dark at the time of the events as many of the other characters. Remember, however, that he's telling this in retrospect, and yet, in retrospect, he doesn't tell us what he will learn later. All right, so this is a fairly sophisticated way of using the central intelligence concept, but without giving us a narrator who is nevertheless somewhat detached from the action. So he's a full participant. He knows these people. Now, we get some passages in which the fact that he knows these people gives the narration a peculiar, almost comic tone at times. So I took in some of that. At the beginning, he tells us about, in by way of an introduction, he tells us about his friend, Mr. Verkhovensky. And he says that this is on the part one, very first page, page 21. He says that he'd always played a rather special and, as were, civic role amongst us, and he loved that role passionately, so much so that I cannot help feeling that he would not have been able to exist without it. Not that I have any intention of comparing him to an actor on the stage, God forbid. Particularly as I have the utmost respect for him. Perhaps it was all just a matter of habit, and so on. And then on the next page, there at the end of that paragraph at the top, he's described as being like Gulliver in Gulliver's Travels, returning from the country of the Lilliputians, which I find very amusing indeed. If you read Gulliver's Travels and you know the famous fourth book, and Gulliver comes back and he can't stand the smell of human beings and prefers to be in the stable and likes the groomer of the horses better than any other person in his household, including his wife and children. And so he ends by saying he was a most excellent man. And then we get this amusing account, well, of his past. He was a professor for a while. He managed to deliver a few lectures about the Arabs, I think. Not quite sure. He had time to defend a brilliant thesis on the civic and Hanseatic importance of the little German town of Hanau during the period between 1413 and 1428, and simultaneously on the special and rather obscure reasons why that promise was never fulfilled. Right. You know, obviously an earth-shaking revelation. But then he goes on to say, this thesis was a shrewd and painful blow at the Slavophiles of the day, and it once made him innumerable and bitter enemies among them. He doesn't explain how. In fact, you need probably notes, and there's some useful notes in the newer PVR Volokhonsky translation, and I'll scan those and post them for you. Unfortunately, of course, they're footnotes that are numbered in this edition, so what you'll have to do is just sort of hold in abeyance your questions about who these things are he's talking about, or people, and then I'll try to get this done early next week, and then you can scan the footnotes. You might actually see a name or a citation that you recognize and can be enlightened about. All right, so he goes on. He lost his position at the university. He managed to publish by way of revenge and just to show them what a man they had lost in a monthly progressive periodical which translated Dickens and propagated the ideas of Georges Sand, the beginning of a most profound work of research into the causes, I believe, of the extraordinary moral nobility of certain knights of a certain epoch, or something of the kind. All right. And then he goes on the next page, 24, to talk about his poetic play, inspired by Faust. And apparently he had some esteem for it, because the copy that he gives to the narrator, and since you may not remember who in the heck Anton Lavrentyevich is, I'll just call him the narrator from here on. All right, so you don't get him confused with the characters who play a more prominent role. That play is lying now on my table. I received it about a year ago from Mr. Verkhovensky, who had only recently copied it out in his own hand. It bears his own autograph and is bound in magnificent red morocco, presumably unpublished, you see. I must admit, it is not without poetic merit and even some talent. Damning with faint praise? It is strange. But in those days, in the 30s, people often wrote that kind of poetic drama. I'm rather at a loss to tell you what it's all about, because to be frank, I can't make head or tail of it. It is some sort of allegory in lyrical and dramatic form, recalling the second act of Faust. Now, you know that in Goethe's Faust, the first part and the second part are radically different in style. The first part is more or less, well, sort of along the lines of Marlowe's Faustus, but not quite. But Faust seduces Marguerite, but at the end she she dies and she goes up to heaven escorted by the angels. In the second part, though written many years later, decades later, then Goethe does some very radical things. He has characters like a wind vane blowing counterclockwise speaking and a wind vane blowing clockwise speaking. You know, there are inanimate objects that speak in Faust Part Two. So he says...
He does have a chorus of insects, too.
Yes, and a chorus of insects, all sorts of wonderful things. I really like Part Two. But anyway, in this one, it opens with a chorus of women, followed by a chorus of men, then a chorus of some spirits, and lastly, a chorus of souls which have never lived, but which are very anxious to live. All these choruses sing about something very indefinite, mostly about somebody's curse, but with a suggestion of the loftiest humor. Then the scene suddenly changes and a sort of festival of life begins, in which even insects join in the singing, as Dr. Gow is pointing out. There he's drawing on the original. A tortoise appears with certain sacramental Latin words, and if I remember rightly, even some mineral, that is, quite an inanimate object, also burst into song about something or other. In fact, they all sing incessantly, and when they speak, they seem to abuse each other vaguely, but again with a suggestion of some higher meaning. At last, the scene changes into a blasted heath, and a cultured young man wanders among the rocks, picking and sucking certain herbs. Asked by a fairy why he sucks those herbs, he replies that feeling a superabundance of life in himself, he seeks forgetfulness and finds it in the juice of these herbs, but that his dearest wish is to lose his reason as soon as possible. A wish that seems to be quite superfluous. Then a young man of indescribable beauty suddenly comes riding in on a black horse, followed by a vast concourse of all the nations. The young man symbolizes death, and all the nations yearn for it. And finally, in the last scene of all, the Tower of Babel appears, and some athletes at last finish building it with a song of new hope. And when they reach the top, the Lord of Olympus, I suppose, runs off in a comic fashion, and mankind, realizing the position and seizing his place, at once begin a new life with a new insight into things. It was that sort of poetic play that was considered dangerous in those days. Now, in fact, as nonsensical as it sounds, the play really does adumbrate many of the major themes of the novel. And so we have to pay some attention to those themes and those images. First of all, there's the matter of the rider on the black horse representing death. Now, nothing new here. This is straight out of the apocalypse. It's the pale horse, pale rider that is death, one of the four horses of the apocalypse. Now, this apocalyptic literature that plays so prominent a role in Dostoevsky's novels right at this time is linked up with two concurrent movements. The first is one that we've already said some things about, and that is Russian messianism. The sense that Russia, Holy Russia, has a world, you might say, destiny, which is to bring a certain set of transcendent values to a world that has lost its way, meaning mainly Western Europe, which has become materialistic and which has become power mad. And so the Russian Messiah is, of course, Christ, but it's the Russian Christ. And we've already seen that there are certain aspects of this at play, for sure, in The Idiot. And we have to be very careful here because reading Dostoevsky's notebooks, I think many generations of critics have been misled into thinking that Mishkin is meant to be somehow Dostoevsky's depiction of this Russian Christ. So we'll come to this again when we get to the Karamazov brothers. I don't know why they translate it as the brothers Karamazov. I mean, would people refer to me and my sibling as the brothers Dupree?
It makes you sound more dashing.
That would be hard to do. I feel rather more like Stepan Trofimovich. All right. The apocalypse is about, as I said, I think, earlier, about the unveiling, the final revelations at the end of time. And so the things to be revealed at the end then give us what is, in effect, a kind of Dostoevskian paradigm, really a plot paradigm. And if you understand this, and if you go back, perhaps, and just glance very quickly over the apocalypse in the Bible, you'll see that it's filled with strange symbols that are very difficult, perhaps almost impossible, to interpret in a definitive way. But that at the end of time, all of these strange and sometimes downright grotesque images will be revealed for what they are. Now, what Christianity does is to take the myth of the declining world. I've already mentioned this, but I'll remind you of it again. It takes the myth of a declining world and leaves that to the secular world, if you will. That is, the secular world, the world that the life that we live on earth, the physical world, nature, all of that, remains the same. It's now up, now down, but it has no definite direction. It's the world of the spirit. It's the world that exists in Augustine's City of God. It is this special community of believers, then, that can look forward to something beyond this world of repetitiveness and ordinary meanings. And we will be lifted onto a new plane. But this will not happen until this world has run its course. That is, it will be replaced by something higher. So, there is the way in which we account for this world, that is, the world that we live in on a day-to-day basis. And in that world, we can make sense of random events and perhaps even causal connections only in retrospect. And if you think about this, you'll see that that's very much the way that Dostoevsky's novelistic style works. Things are tied up, all right, but they don't come to their completion until the climax, the very end of the novel. This was true in the death of Nastasia Filipova in The Idiot. So it's not until that death scene that everything that was going on culminates in an apocalyptic moment. Is she the whore of Babylon, or is she the sacrificial lamb at the end? You see, you can say what's being revealed in that last scene. And we're not quite sure. It's ambiguous. And that's because the end may be near at hand, but it hasn't reached us yet. And so we see certain signs of the end. Now, these signs of the end in the apocalypse have to be interpreted. Remember, the revelation of John dates from about 90 to 95 AD, so in the very end of the first century. What it points to is the second coming, new heaven, new earth. And And that means a redemption, then, of the natural world into a higher existence. But in that higher existence, the old order then is destroyed, and the new order then is revealed, and everything is transformed. Well, this notion of transformation of a world then that has run its course plays a very important role in the notion of the three Romes that we've already talked about. So the first Rome was Rome, Italy, of course, what we call Rome, Italy now. That fell. The empire was transferred to Constantinople, the second Rome. That fell. And of course, Christianity had transformed pagan Rome during the time of Constantine, and it was Constantine who transferred the empire to the east, and the empire by that time had grown to encompass a great extent of the known world. Now, it is Moscow that is the third Rome. Moscow has taken on the mantle. It will again revive what Constantinople once stood for and has lost. Right? So this is part of this Russian messianic notion. And this was a very powerful one among the Slavophiles. For the Westernizers, of course, Moscow was a backwater. What do you mean it's the third Rome? They've never heard of it in Western Europe. But this notion of a messianic calling for Russia then was tied up with the notion that one must suffer in order to understand. And so the Russian mind then embraces suffering as preparing Christianity, just as the Jews had to learn from their suffering as a people, for its ultimate historical role in bringing man closer to God. And you recall that for the Jews, the Messiah is both a religious figure and a political figure. And although the Jews don't expect to take over the world, that's not the idea, they do expect to lead the world into a new heaven and a new earth with the coming of the Messiah. And likewise, the Russian Messiah, who is Christ, then is the hope then for mankind. The only hope. The fact that Christ has already come and that he is depicted, interestingly enough, mostly in Orthodox iconology as the triumphant Christ, the Pantocrator, the ruler of all, rather than the crucified Christ, the suffering Christ, you see, is about this revelation of things at the end of time. By the way, it was during the time of Tsar Ivan IV, who was crowned in 1547, that the myth of Holy Russia and its mission was consolidated. It was then that the church was brought into direct association with the Russian Empire. And in the next century, so the 17th century, we get a schismatic movement known as the Old Believers. Now, you'll hardly believe this yourself, but what they argued over was not deep matters of theology, you know, like the one that split the East and the West over whether or not the Son proceeds from the Father alone or from the Father and the Holy Ghost. No, nothing like that. It was how many fingers should you use in making the sign of the cross. I mean, this gets down to very seemingly minor details, but nevertheless, there was a big split with the Old Believers. And the Old Believers then had their own apocalyptic vision, and they saw the coming of the beast with the Petrine reforms. So the founding of St. Petersburg then was a direct slap at the myth of Holy Russia By the way, there still are old believers, incidentally, who haven't reunited with the Russian Orthodox Church. There are a number of old believer communities in this country. This is where a lot of them came.
So they're considered a different denomination?
Yeah.
And they're not even communing with the church because they want to know how to make the sign of the cross?
That's right. Well, among other things, but yeah. They didn't like the direction things had gone, and they didn't like the association of the church with the state, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. But anyway, now we get, you see, this problematic that comes with Petersburg, and that is, were Peter the Great's reforms a new golden age, the beginning of a new golden age, or were they the appearance of the Antichrist? And you know, the Antichrist will come at the end of time too, and a lot of people will be drawn to the Antichrist. And this gets us directly into the main features that we find in part one and throughout the rest of the novel, called The Devils. By the way, the Whore of Babylon, in at least Russian Orthodox interpretations of the Apocalypse, is of course the Church of Rome. So all of this then is in the background. But now in the foreground is another transformation. First we have the Enlightenment, and of course Peter the Great represents the early part of the Enlightenment. But then at the end of the 18th century and into the early 19th century, then we get something else. We get the beginnings of a new utopianism. This is a series of movements. People like Robert Owen in England, or the Count of Saint-Simon in France, and especially a man by the name of Charles Fourier. And Fourier is mentioned in The Demons. As a matter of fact, Dostoevsky was familiar with his work because Belinsky and his circle, of which Dostoevsky was a part in the mid-40s, he and his circle studied Fourier's theories very closely. Now, I don't have time to tell you about this strange utopian theorist, but his disciple and chief propagandist and a utopian theorist in his own right was a man with the curious name, another Frenchman, of Victor Considérant. And Considérant established a number of attempts at Fourierist colonies. Well, the Fourierist movement housed everybody in a very large building complex called a phalanstery. And there are all kinds of weird things I could tell you about involving phalansteries. But suffice it to say that in some of his more extreme writings, Fourier, who was an early feminist, who wrote in support of, and in fact, oh, by the way, he was a traveling salesman, if you wonder what he did for a living. A very strange figure in some ways. But in any case, he was big on the emancipation of women, and he was very much interested in work and production, and the phalanstery was supposed to solve a number of problems of work and production. And as a salesman, he had seen the worst of what the mercantile world had to offer. But at the same time, he also wanted to liberate people, and liberate them as individuals, curiously enough, so they would lead a communal life, but it would be a communal life that would let them realize themselves as individuals. So we mustn't confuse Fourier and his utopian ideas with those of Marx and Engels. And Marx and Engels were both very familiar with Fourier, in some cases learned from him, but in others criticized him as a utopian dreamer. So by the time The Devils is written, a lot of utopian water has flowed under the bridge, you might say. It has become a mighty river, at least in the minds of some people and their followers. Well, stop for a moment and realize that these schemes then, not all of which agreed with one another, were, you might say, self-described. Saint-Simon, not so much Fourier, although in a way, as being Christianity for the 19th century. Now, what they rejected was the official church, Russian Orthodox or Roman Catholic or Protestant or whatever it was, although there were also some Protestant utopian sects. A lot of them ended up on this side of the Atlantic, by the way. Anyhow, the model here was Christ. But it was Christ as the model for the new socialism. This term socialism dates from the 1830s only. That's when it emerges and becomes popular. So you have to bear that in mind. It's only about four decades before the writing of The Devils that this term emerges in Europe. And it was in 1848 with the fall in France of the July monarchy, the restored monarchy, and the revolution that Marx and Engels write the Communist Manifesto. Dostoevsky never mentions Marx and Engels. Why not? Because they weren't very prominent at this point. Their prominence, their rise to prominence, occurs in the 1870s and on. Okay, so right about the time that The Devils is being composed, then Marx and Engels are beginning to write their major works and coming to the attention of a larger audience in Western Europe. And by the way, it's fascinating to see how some of the characters in this novel really do anticipate subsequent history in Russia. But that's another story. It's some 50 years later after Dostoevsky writes it, so we won't worry about it yet. It's another apocalypse, as it were. All right, so here you have a kind of Christian socialism, and it's based on the image of Christ understood in a certain way. That is, a Christ who will lead us to social harmony. We will love one another. We will learn how to benefit one another as individuals. And this is what Marx and Engels scornfully called utopian socialism. A recent book on Victor Considérant calls it romantic socialism, which I think is a pretty good way of referring to it. By the way, I mentioned that Victor Considérant started several colonies. They all failed, but one lasted longer than any other Fourierist colony. Do you have any idea where that was?
Massachusetts?
No, although, do you know Hawthorne's Blithedale, I'm going to say bridesmaid, Blithedale Romance, which is based on Brook Farm, which was an attempt at a Fourierist colony. No, that wasn't it, believe it or not. Any idea?
Russia.
Nope. How many of you have a car? Or access to a car? Drive to West Dallas, between Westmoreland and Hampton, right at the edge of Irving. In fact, part of it's in the... That's right. It's a place called La Réunion, 1855 to 1860, a Fourierist colony that Victor Considérant himself presided over.
Only lasted
5 years? Yeah. It's a complicated story. It's not has nothing to do with Dostoevsky. But Dostoevsky does mention Victor Considérant because he had read his writings. Right? I just want you to know that these things are not far off events. You know, they happen right here. Dallas was only a, you know, 15 or so, not even, barely over a decade old when this colony was founded.
Was this
Reunion Tower is named after it, by the way.
Are you serious?
Yeah. See, you're ignorant of the very land you live in. I couldn't wait to spring this on you, I confess.
Dostoevsky, when he was accused of being socialist, is this the socialist movement he was accused of being involved in?
Yes, the Romantic Socialist movement.
It was based on Christianity.
In a vague, I would say, they like to think of themselves as inspired by the Gospels and by the example of Christ.
But it wasn't necessarily a religious group.
No, not really. Now, you see, it's this secularization that takes the apocalyptic, the mission of Holy Russia, all of these, let's call them sort of platforms, as it were, that makes sense of what otherwise is the chaos of events in history and in the world. They give it a direction and a meaning. See, secularize these. Instead of looking for the world beyond this world, say, wait a minute, Christ told us to love one another. How can we make that happen? Now! So you get... By the way, the French Revolution, in their eyes, was a disaster. What it generated was not love of mankind for one another. It generated violence and hatred. So what they thought was that clearly something had gone wrong there. We don't want that to happen again. These socialists didn't believe in violent revolutions. And this is the kind of liberal that Stepan Trofimovich is. You had a question back.
Oh, yes. I was just wondering, she said that Dostoevsky was accused of being a part of, and I was just wondering a little more to what extent he was kind of a part of this.
Oh, yeah, he was very much a part of it.
Okay, so he was like a full-blown...
Well, he tagged along with Belinsky's group.
Okay.
They were seen as dangerous for various reasons. And they came down very hard on them. Now remember, the Decembrists the Decembrists were liberals. They wanted to do away with the Tsardom after the death of Alexander I and prevent the accession of Nicholas I to the throne. And so they were seen, even if they were in some respects intellectuals and fairly innocuous. Now what Dostoevsky will do in The Devils is show that this later generation of radicals are a very different matter from the romantic socialism of the earlier generation. And so going back now to that Faust thing, you see the 1830s, think about that. This is the time when all of that was coming to the fore. Fourier is alive. Then Victor Considérant, his first work is published around 1840 or so on. There were others like Saint-Simon and so on and so forth. There was a lot of this going on in Europe. There were German utopians. And by the way, if you're interested in this whole fascinating story, there is a kind of classic work called Utopian Thought in Western Culture by Frank and Fritzi Manuel. M-A-N-U-E-L. And yes, we have it in our library. Nice, thick book. It's a huge survey of all of this. Unfortunately, the section on Fourier and Saint-Simon and Owen and Cabot, another French utopian, is mostly tied up with the early Marx in that chapter. So you have to look elsewhere for a really full account of Fourier's very odd thought. But I'll give you a little bit more of that as we go along. But now with this later generation, what we see is that the somewhat gentle socialism of a man like Verkhovensky turns violent. Now, let me just explain the difference between Marx on the one hand and Fourier on the other. Fourier and his fellow Romantic socialist didn't want to do away with class distinctions. They thought the upper class would help then initiate and bring about these very reforms once they saw its importance. So they weren't interested in necessarily, they believed in democracy, of course, but they didn't want to do with necessarily away with class structures as they existed. They wanted to improve them. They wanted everybody to be happy. They wanted everybody to have an equal chance. But you could be happy as a peasant. You could be unhappy as a powerful aristocrat, as Dostoevsky demonstrates. And so do several other novelists, don't they? But what they believed was that you had to find various principles, rational principles, make people think rationally, so they would work together as a community. Now see, this goes back to this notion of togetherness in Russian thought, this communal character of traditional Russia. And so you can see how you could move this forward a little bit, secularize it somewhat, draw on it, and it'd be very attractive. So yes, Dostoevsky was part of this Christian-tinged socialism in Belinsky's circle, and in fact, Belinsky himself believed in it. All right, so taking care of the poor, you know, creating better social structures for dealing the problems of poverty, and so on and so forth. Marx is different. Marx believes that there is an inevitable clash of the classes, and that the proletariat will win out. Right? So that's where Marx departs company altogether with the Romantic socialist. And there, violence leads into all of this. By the way, Marx was a good old bourgeois papa. You know, a perfectly proper man. Not really a wild man at all. Not like, at all, some of his contemporaries, fictional contemporaries in The Devils. Perfectly, a papa fond of his daughters and his wife, lived a perfectly middle-class existence. It's true that he was got in trouble politically various times, but lived in London and went to the British Museum and wrote Das Kapital unobtrusively. But there was another man, a Russian by the name of Bakunin, who was also in London, and whom Dostoevsky knew, and who was much more a radical socialist, in fact, a communist, and who is part of the patrimony of Russian communism, in fact. All right? So Dostoevsky was aware of all of these things, and he saw the consequences of moving in this direction towards violence. But he also saw that this direction towards violence, and this is the apocalyptic side, the apocalyptic plot, he saw that it was inevitable once you had taken that first step of secularizing Christian values. Now, we have a number of other things to explore, but I want to give you something very striking to think about. There is a character in this novel who has had a considerable impact on subsequent thinkers, especially on Albert Camus. And you know that Dostoevsky has been grouped among with the existentialists who were very popular when I was an undergraduate in the late 50s, in the 50s and the early 60s and so on. There was a book by Walter Kaufmann called From Dostoevsky to Existentialism. And a lot of this is based on one character in this novel, Kirillov. Kirillov is the man who wants to be the man-god, or the god, not the god-man. Now, I realize that there is more to come and that you haven't read quite enough to get the full picture in part one, and you may not have finished part one, but in part one, there is a discussion with Kirillov. This is on page 126. If you understand what I'm trying to explain about this apocalyptic plot and this apocalyptic scheme now secularized, what we will get is not new heaven and new earth, but the new man who will bring about new heaven and new earth. All right? Man will be transformed, and he will be liberated from all of these old tyrannies of church and state and class and so on. And every individual then will be God, because he will have his will as an individual. So on page 126, it says, why is it that people are afraid of death? Life is pain, life is fear, and man is unhappy. Now all is pain and fear. Now man loves life, and that's how they've done it. You're given life now for pain and fear, and that's where the whole deception lies. Now man is not yet what he will be. A new man will come, happy and proud, to whom it won't matter whether he lives or not. He'll be the new man. He who conquers pain and fear will himself be a god, and that other god will not be. So according to you, the other god does exist after all. He doesn't exist, but he is. What? But you notice that, as a matter of fact, even Shatov, who is converted from being a radical now to being a Slavophil, even he isn't. He says, do you believe in God? And he says, I will believe in God. You see? That is, I have to believe in God because I need him for my principles. But can you will belief? Ah, there we are. He doesn't exist, but he is. That is, we have an idea of him. There's no pain in a stone, but there's pain in the fear of a stone. He who conquers pain and fear will himself become a god. Then there will be a new life, a new man. Everything will be new. You see, this is either a recovery of the Garden of Eden, or it's new heaven and new earth. Then history will be divided into two parts, from the guerrilla to the annihilation of God, and from the annihilation of God to the guerrilla? Is Darwin here yet? Almost. But the Darwinian arguments and controversy have not, well, have in fact erupted, you see. This is 1871. All right, so to the physical transformation of the earth and man. Man will be God. He'll be physically transformed. And the world too will be transformed. And things will be transformed. And thoughts and all feelings. What do you think? Will man be physically transformed then? If it's all the same whether to live or not to live, everyone will kill himself. And that's perhaps the only change that will come about. Makes no difference. Deception will be killed. Everyone who desires supreme freedom must dare to kill himself. He who dares to kill himself has learned the secret of the deception. Beyond that, there is no freedom. That's all. And beyond it, there is nothing. He who dares to kill himself is a god. Now, everyone can make it so that there shall be no god and there shall be nothing. But no one has done so yet. Now, this may seem to you very odd reasoning. So I'm going to try to clarify just what's happening here by turning to an anthropologist. He happens to be a Catholic anthropologist, but that's neither here nor there. This is Mary Douglas in a book called Purity and Danger, which was published in 1966. Mary Douglas is a British anthropologist, and at the book itself asks all kinds of questions about purifying rituals and pollution rituals. Rituals, religious or not religious, that are carried out in order to ward off pollution and to restore purity. Now, pollution, not in the sense that we mean it now necessarily, although that too, you see, we're part of this when we worry about the ecology. We're developing our own rituals for dealing with a pollution that purifies nature, the world, the environment, which works fine by itself, but we have polluted it. It's the new fall of nature that we're responsible for, and we have to fix it. And we can only fix it in one of two ways: by restoring the Edenic world or through science and engineering. All right, so we haven't escaped from any of this apocalyptic stuff. We're right in the middle of a new apocalyptic myth. It's the destruction of the earth and ourselves with it. At the end of Mary Douglas's book, and she, as anthropologists do, she draws on non-European societies for illustrations. And she talks about, in this case, two African rituals involved with killing. An Ndembu ritual, and then a Dinka ritual. Now, I'm just going to read from the last two pages of this book, and then I'll explain the connection, all right? But you'll probably make the connection before I need to explain it. All right, so she begins by saying she's going to give another example of death being softened by welcome. If we can put it that way, is the ritual murder by which the Dinka, an African tribe, put to death their aged spear masters. By the way, a friend of mine gave me a little statue of a Dinka spear master holding his spear. And they, at an old age, they stand out and guard the village. Stand there. They, obviously, they don't have the strength to fight anymore. But it's part of the ritual of guarding the community. So they're the guardians of the community. This is the central rite in Dinka religion. All their other rites and bloodily expressive sacrifices pale in significance besides this one, which is not a sacrifice. The spear masters are a hereditary clan of priests. Their divinity, flesh, is a symbol of life, light, and truth. Spear masters may be possessed by the divinity. The sacrifices they perform and blessings they give are more efficacious than other men's. They mediate between their tribe and divinity. The doctrine underlying the ritual of their death is that the spear master's life should not be allowed to escape with his last breath from his dying body. By keeping his life in his body, his life is preserved, and the spirit of the spear master is thus transmitted to his successor for the good of the community. The community can live on as a rational order because of the unafraid self-sacrifice of its priest. By reputation among foreign travelers, this rite was a brutal suffocation of a helpless old man. An intimate study of Dinka religious ideas reveals the central theme to be the old man's voluntary choosing of the time, manner, and place of his death. The old man himself asked for the death to be prepared for. He asked for it from his people and on their behalf. He is reverently carried to his grave, and lying in it says his last words to his grieving sons before his natural death is anticipated. By his free, deliberate decision, he robs death of the uncertainty of its time and place of coming. His own willing death, ritually framed by the grave itself, is a communal victory for all his people. By confronting death and grasping it firmly, he has said something to his people about the nature of life. And then she goes on to say, the common element in these two examples of death ritual is the exercise of free, rational choice in undergoing death. Something, and she goes on to mention something else that I'll skip over. Animal and vegetable life cannot help but play their role in the order of the universe. They have little choice but to live it as it is their nature to behave. Occasionally, the odd species or individual gets out of line, and humans react by avoidance of one kind or another. The very reaction to ambiguous behavior expresses the expectation that all things shall normally conform to the principles which govern the world. But in their own experience as men, people know that their personal conformity is not so certain. Punishments, moral pressures, rules about not touching and not eating, a firm ritual framework, all these can do something to bring man into harmony with the rest of being. But so long as free consent is withheld, so long is the fulfillment imperfect. Here again we can discern primitive existentialists whose escape from the chain of necessity lies only in the exercise of choice. When someone embraces freely the symbols of death or death itself, then it is consistent with everything that we have seen so far that a great release of power for good should be expected to follow. The old spear master, giving the sign for his own slaying, makes a stiffly ritual act. It has none of the exuberance of St. Francis of Assisi rolling naked in the filth and welcoming his sister death. But his act touches the same mystery. If anyone held the idea that death and suffering are not an integral part of nature, the delusion is corrected. If there was a temptation to treat ritual as a magic lamp, to be rubbed for gaining unlimited riches and power, ritual shows its other side. If the hierarchy of values was crudely material, it is dramatically undermined by paradox and contradiction. In painting such dark themes, pollution symbols are as necessary as the use of black in any depiction whatsoever. Therefore, we find corruption enshrined in sacred places and times. By the way, I put all this on blackboard for you, if you want to refer to it.
Mm-hmm. Is this Dinka ritual still practiced today?
You mean 40 years later, 43 years later?
I didn't know she was talking about book? Something in the 1600s or the...
No, no, she's talking about 20th century Dinka practice.
Current.
Yeah.
That's really disturbing.
Why?
Well,
look how she reads it.
You don't believe in assisted suicide.
Yeah, but you see, you have to think about what values you hold mean in the context of the whole. For the Dinka, this is not an assisted suicide, exactly. It's a ritual. And there is something like a crucifixion going on here, if you think about it. The spear masters and this ritual are at the very center of their culture. So not it's not allowed for anybody else. And these people are then very, very special people indeed. They are honored as no other person is honored. The spear master who has shown that he can overcome the most important uncertainty for all of us. He will know the exact time, manner, and place of his death. He has a certain knowledge. It's the only certain knowledge that anyone will have. And he is privileged above all other men because he has that knowledge. And this makes him, in a way, as close to a god as you can get, doesn't it? So you have to think about Kirillov's claim now that if everybody is free to kill himself, then everybody is God. There will be no God. I have power over my own existence. I don't have power to bring myself into existence, however you might do that, but I have power to end it. And this is a power that everybody has, as a matter of fact. So why do we discourage suicide? Well, for obvious reasons. I don't think we need to go into the whole question of suicide. Although I will mention that Emil Durkheim, one of the most important of the early French anthropologists at the end of the 19th century, who sort of invented, to a great extent, the discipline of ethnography, wrote his first book on suicide, as a matter of fact. And so it's interesting to see Kirillov anticipating these insights in a terrible fashion, but a good half century before anyone else had come up with it or had witnessed anything even remotely like it anywhere else in the world. Well, we're out of time, aren't we?
Just a quick question. We're supposed to have read through the first half.
Do what you can.
Tuesday, so what does that look like, half?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question. It doesn't look like what you think. When you get to chapter 8 of part 2, read next the appendix. All right? That was a chapter that the censors forced Dostoevsky to cut. He tried to rewrite it and couldn't. It is absolutely crucial to this novel.
That's before or after chapter 8?
Before or after chapter 8?
You know, it should be after chapter 8. It should be chapter 9.
So they don't just insert it back in the book like they put it as a...
Well, the problem here is that Dostoevsky himself, I mean, he gave up and just... it remained in page proofs, and he tried to go through and correct it to satisfy the censors, and there was a page missing from the page proofs, by the way, but his wife, remember, she was his stenographer, had a copy, another copy of it in manuscript that supplies the missing page. So we have the whole thing. What's printed these days is not the page proofs with the corrections that Dostoevsky did, but his first intention. Okay? So you want to read Tichon's, at Tichon's, the appendix matter. I hope the chapters are the same in this edition as they are in all the others. I'm pretty sure they are, but it should be after chapter 8. Okay. Now, if you add up all those page numbers, divide by 2, and see if you can come to a chapter in that is somewhere close to 2, and you'll be fine. Okay? Any other questions, comments?
When was that Dallas Utopian community? Was that pre or post 1845?
1855 to 1860.
Okay.
Then the Civil War came and sort of, yeah.
But
Civil War came and gave it the coup de grace.